Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Ray spent a little bit of time watching me and said this kid has no chance.
Oh my God, Renee.
Oh my God, Caitlin.
You're in Singapore. What's up?
I am in Singapore. I am overlooking the beautiful harbour here with the 600,000 shipping and hauling and cargo boats. It's hot, humid, but thankfully we're playing the WTA finals here in Singapore indoors.
It is freezing cold in New York. Don't hurry back. Winter has come for us all.
Oh no. So you're telling me I need to make sure I have my tan set before I come back.
Yeah, you're going to need your tan to last all through the winter because it is freezing. Here.
Oh, God.
So I'm very jealous you're in Singapore eating some noodles at night markets and watching some great tennis. What's going on down there?
Watching some great tennis. I'll tell you what, if you live in this area of the world, this is the best tournament to come and watch all year long, whether it be the WTA finals, the ATP finals. You get to watch the best players in the world literally duking it out every single night. So last night we had a... two straight set victories, which is not usual on the WTA finals. Usually you have three sets, you know, battles. And believe me, I'm sure they're to come. There's no question about that. But Svitolina was a bit of a surprise straight sets victory over Kvitova last night. And Kaya, as I call her, Karolina Pliskova, had a really great two-set win over the defending champion and Caroline Wozniacki last night. So... I'm working with Carolina, as everybody knows. So it was a good night for Team Racket. Let's just put it that way.
Team Racket. She was looking good in her Racket t-shirt before. I'm pretty sure that had something to do with her victory.
Yeah.
And she won it on an ace. She's the ace queen, after all. So it was really, really fun to watch her get off to a good start there. Hopefully, you know, obviously she does really well this week.
Yeah, that's the thing about the WTA finals is that, you know, you could have a great first match and it's just like, oh, well, get over it because now you've got to play another great player in a day. So, you know, it's one of those tournaments that you kind of have a great high and then you've got to get quickly back down to earth and get back to work because there's no guarantees. You know, it depends on how people win. Is it straight sets? Do they win all their matches? You know, everybody could win one match or two matches. I mean, there's been people, and Dominika Sibulkova won the tournament here 1 year and only won one match in the round robin event. So, you know, everybody knows very clearly that winning one match is no guarantee of a semifinal berth. So we've got a lot of work to do.
Well, one of the things that happened in addition to Kaya winning was you got to sit down with one of the most successful coaches in the world, your good friend, Darren Cahill, who joins us for this week's episode. Tell me about that.
I did. Obviously, Darren was here with Simona Halep, who unfortunately had to pull out of the tournament due to, you know, this nagging back problem that she's sustained in China. So, you know, it's always a bummer to not have the world number one here. But Darren was here. They were here. They get the, you know, the trophy for the world, NEU world number one. So the whole team was here, ready to go to play, but they couldn't. So he was off back home to Australia last night. So I nabbed him yesterday before he could get on that plane. As we know, our Racket magazine podcast listeners have really requested Darren through the last few months, and we got him, and we've got some classic stories from a classic Aussie, I laughed throughout it all. We were a little naughty with one another, so it's a lot of fun.
Well, when I was editing it today, I had to stop it a few times and rewind it and play it for my wife, Claire, because I was laughing out loud, and she kept asking me what I was laughing at, and there was copious moments, so it really did not disappoint. obviously the hilarious stories were a highlight, but also what like amazingly interesting stuff he gets into from working with Andre Agassi, his own career. Obviously you guys sharing a lot of history there with the Australian Sports Institute. It was really great. What a fantastic, thoughtful guy he is with a really awesome sounding wife.
Yeah, Vicky's, you know, she's the rock, right? She's the one that's got the sense of humor in the family, clearly, as we'll hear from this podcast. But yeah, you know, just it goes back and talks about the history of how he got into tennis, how he ended up in coaching, which was interesting in itself. You know, going from playing to a little transitional period of what he did after that, and then obviously into such a great coaching role, on top of the fact that he's one of the best tennis analysts in the world, clearly working many hours with me at ESPN, and he's a great listen. He's my favorite commentator. So, yeah, he's just a great guy all around, really.
It's a great interview, and before I get to it, the one thing I wanted to give you an update on is I finished the Li Na book that I stole from your apartment, My Life by Li Na. What a great book. It is so fun, and she writes you a hilarious dedication in the front. To Stubbsy, I hope you enjoy reading my book, Li Na. What a great book. I hope if you're there and you get a chance to grab her, I would love to have her on the show because I'm a huge Li Na fan. More so now that I've read her book. Everyone should go out and read it. It's really, really thoughtful and interesting.
Yeah, unfortunately, I tried to grab her when I was in Wuhan, but, you know, she's super busy with the tournament there. And then, you know, unfortunately, Kaya lost pretty early in the tournament, so we were out of there. But, you know, inevitably I will try and grab her at some stage for our pod in the future because she is a great listen.
Her and Jian Chang, a.k.a. Dennis. All right, without further ado, listen up for our fantastic interview with Darren Cahill coming up right now.
Well, here we are in Singapore. We're actually overlooking the port of Singapore. It's beautiful. And I'm joined by my very good friend, fellow Aussie. It seems to be a bit of a theme that I keep getting these Aussies on here, but I'm here with Darren Cahill, coach of course, Simona Halep, world number one again this year. My good friend. Thanks for joining me, killer.
My pleasure. I'm a little bit nervous.
Oh, God, please.
No, you do make me nervous. You know that.
Oh, well, you know.
Yeah.
Well, let's not get into that reason. All right, first question I want to ask you is, and I guess a lot of people want to know this, including me, why the name killer?
I would love to be able to say that it's a really interesting story, but it's a bit of a boring story, actually. There was a guy called Mark Beers. You're a little bit too young to remember Mark. He was from Victoria, and I was a late developer. I reckon I was the smallest kid in my class at year 11, 16, going to St. Michael's in Adelaide. But I could play decent tennis, and Mark Beers was another tennis player from Victoria, and I walked in, and he knew me. Our fathers played football, AFL football together, and actually Mark ended up playing for Collingwood, which my father coached him a few years later than that. But because I could play decent tennis, and I was so small, he actually nicknamed me the Little Killer. So that stuck, Little Killer, and then about 18 months later, I think I grew about a foot. I went from about 5'2" to 6'2". And little got dumped. And I became killer. So it's a boring story.
You didn't
but
become big killer?
Nah, just
killer.
The killer.
That's classic. Actually, that brings me to the point of why tennis? Because a lot of people, obviously, in the tennis world don't know that your father was a very, very good AFL footy player, Australian rules football, for those of you around the world. Of course, Australians know what I'm talking about. But why tennis? Why not football?
No, my father was a closet tennis player. He loved it. And the first thing he did when he made a bit of money was that he put a tennis court in the back of our house. And he was a lefty, a serve volleyer. And he used to make me sit up and watch all the Borg-McEnroe finals at Wimbledon. It was the only time I could stay up late was to watch those matches. And we got hooked on those amazing matches those guys played. And he tried to play like McEnroe. And he'd take me out the back and beat me up. So we just ended up playing a lot of tennis. I played football as well until I was about 16. Decent. I'm not sure that I would have made it as a footballer because I'm pretty light framed.
Not with your knees. Either.
No, and I would have got banged around quite a bit. But I loved football. I remember my childhood sitting in my room at night just tossing a football up and down and trying to hit the ceiling and taking speckies over my brothers in the house. And
can
going,
you explain what a speckie is?
That's a mark over a pack of players. Mm. And then also getting the football and doing check sides, which is kicking the football sidewards and trying to get it through a door down my passageway of the house. So football was what I did 23 hours of the day in my house, but I played a little bit of tennis as well. And it just worked out that I was a bit better at tennis than I was at football at about 16 or 17. And as you know, at 16 or 17, you have to make a decision. So I chose tennis.
So, okay, so you choose tennis. What was the next, like, sort of, you know, grade for you with tennis? I mean, how did you know that you were an exceptional tennis player?
You know, I caught a break. You remember Bob Carmichael?
I do.
Yeah, Nails passed away a number of years ago, but Nails was an avid AFL follower as well. He loved the Melbourne Football Club, and he knew of my father, so he paid a little more attention to me than he probably should have because of who I was. And he was one of the coaches at the Australian Institute of Sport, and Ray Ruffles was the head coach. And what they had to do is they picked the 10 best 17, 18-year-old males and also female players, and we'd all go to Canberra and live there and train there for a year. I was nowhere near the best 10. And Bob saw a little bit in me, which was, I guess, work ethic, desperation. I was hungry to be, you know, out there on the practice court all the time. And he sort of kept an eye on me as a young player. And so he pitched for me to be included in that 10 players. And Ray spent a bit of time, and Ray will know this, he'll tell this story. Ray spent a little bit of time watching me and said, this kid has no chance. He's not coming. This kid has no chance. And Bob pleaded with him to allow me to come in to the Institute. I got the 10th spot, and that was my big break. From there, I would never have been a tennis player if it wasn't for that.
Oh, God, yeah. I did not know that story. That's so great. Yeah. Well, it's funny how, you know, we're here sitting in Singapore, the two of us, and, you know, we're now coaching on the WTA Tour, and we're also working for ESPN, and we both went to the Australian Institute of Sport. And Ray ended up being one of my coaches.
Yep.
So it's kind of full circle moment, isn't it, really? How small the world is and how lucky small breaks like that, particularly. I never heard that story.
Yeah, so you need those breaks. You need somebody to believe in you. Mm. And Bob Nails was my person that sort of stood over me. And as it turned out, Bob became my coach for my entire career. I never had any other coach than Bob Carmichael. And most of my coaching philosophies come from what he taught me.
Mm. Nails, for those of us in Australian tennis. Two reasons.
One, he was a carpenter, and secondly, he was tough as nails.
Yeah, oh, good. Good memories, because he was, as we say in Australia, a great bloke. So you work your ass off at the Australian Institute of Sport, I know. 4 hours a day on court, 2 hours a day in the gym at least. You're going to school, you're trying to manage all that.
Chasing girls.
I wasn't chasing girls at that point.
You just come up at some stage.
No, come on. Everybody knows. Yeah. Anybody's listening to my podcast or knows anything about me or Google, it's not. But I, you know. Anyway, we won't get into that.
You had a bit of a thing for me though at one stage.
Well,
right?
I think
not
you
really.
Wanted me to.
Not,
no.
Yeah, yeah,
I think you and I missed each other at the Institute.
Yeah, we did.
Yeah, that's probably a good thing. Yes, would have turned me earlier. Anyway, so you go out into the big world of professional tennis. Very different back then. Not as much money, obviously. You really have to. As an Aussie, how many months of the year were you on the road?
Yeah, my first trip overseas was with Barry Phillips Moore, in fact, and I went over there with a group of players, and my father was fortunate that he was doing pretty well, so he financed me away for my first trip. I played 3 satellites back then, and back in those days, a satellite consisted of 5 tournaments, whereas now it's 5 individual weeks for futures events. This was one tournament cut into 5 weeks, so I was away 16 weeks, 4 months on the road. The very last tournament, I came through pre-qualies and in the Austrian satellite, pre-qualies, qualies, and got into the main draw and earned my first ATP point. Mm. And with that, you get a ranking of about 800 back in those days, and that was it. So I got the ranking point. I got a ranking that allowed me to get into some qualifying matches back in Australia. And then you're on the road non-stop, and basically you stay away for as long as your finances allow it. And as soon as you run out of money, you get on a plane and come home. So it's a little bit different now. But it also gave you some toughness as well. And you couldn't take the easy way out. If you were having a bit of a struggle and you're having a couple of bad weeks, you had to put your head down and just work harder, because the option of jumping on a plane and coming home was not there.
Well, especially going back to Australia.
Yep.
Bloody expensive and long hours. You know, 2 days to recover basically every time you went home. So do you remember the most memorable match for you, like in your career, where you were like, I've made it, because that's so wanky, but like where you go, I think I'm a good player. I think I deserve to be out here.
Yeah, no, I always had self-doubts about myself as a player. Even if I had a good win, I felt like I got it given to me. You know, I never could sit back and be that satisfied with a win, because I never felt like I really belonged with the top players in the world. I was kind of the type of player that I could give them a tough battle if they had a bit of an off day, but if they were on, they would normally thump me. So over the course of my career, I got a few good wins over some of the top names, but normally I needed a little bit of help. So I was a tier or two down from that particular level. But at the first real breakthrough for me was coming through the qualies of the French Open.
I think I was on clay.
I never lost three qualies in a row, matches in a row at qualifying Paris. Now, those courts back there are super quick too, and they were bouncy. So my little crappy kick serve. Pat Cash once said I had the best worst serve in the world because it was this crappy kick serve that sort of moved around in the air and bounced up, and no one could actually hit it. Yeah. So on those fast courts, I was pretty hard to beat. And even Paris, when the sun is shining, they actually play really quick.
Yeah, they do.
So I had some decent results in Paris and came through qualies, and I played Mark Dixon, who was ranked 50 in the world, another American, out on court three. You know court three very well. And we played 13-11 in the final fifth set.
Oh my God.
And I won. And yeah. And that was pure joy for me to get through that match and win my first match in a Grand Slam. So, and that also gave me belief that I could play five sets, I could play on different surfaces, and that I could play against somebody ranked so high back then, because I think I was about 400 in the world at that stage. Yeah. So that gave me belief, and I think that was a big kickstart to my career.
And then, you know, what was the reasoning of the retiring, and how difficult is that? Because I think every player really struggles with when to stop.
13 knee surgeries was mine. So I had bad knees from about 18 years of age because of the little killer story I told you about. Yep. I grew so much in the space of 18 months that I had these little golf balls coming out of the bottom of my knees, and once they went away, my tracking of my kneecaps was going outward. So I ended up using all the anticular cartilage inside my kneecap, and basically it was bone on bone by the time I was about 23 years of age. So I retired, or forced out of the game, when I was 25.
Wow.
So pretty young.
Okay, so what was next?
Working in a bar back in Adelaide. I invested in a bar called Aces Bar and Bistro.
Come on.
Yeah, we had a nightclub called The Planet. Do you ever come to Adelaide and go to The Planet?
I did go to The Planet. Wait, you opened it?
We had a piece of that.
Oh, shit, I helped you. I probably helped you a lot.
Players Bar. We had Players Bar also, which was another nightclub with a couple of other people. Tim May, the cricketer, Chris McDermott, the footballer, and Greg Griffin, a lawyer back in Adelaide. So the four of us put together a few little investments. So I was working behind the bar pouring beers, to be honest.
God. Are you good at it?
I'm very good at pouring beers. Wow. I'm very good at giving away free beer.
Oh, yeah. I bet,
especially to everybody I know.
Yeah, especially if you're topping it off a little bit and having a sip to yourself. Wow, so you go into owning a bar, you work behind the bar, and then how the hell did you get into coaching then?
Yeah, I had this little phone call one day from a lady, Sherilyn Hewitt, who called me up and said, hey, listen, I've got a son that we reckon plays pretty well. He's 12 years of age. Is there any chance you could hit with him? And I'd hit with quite a few of the Adelaide kids and been out to a couple of squad trainings and try to help as much as I can. And I was okay. You know, my knees were not good enough to play professionally, but certainly I could play. I was fine. So I got a knock on the door. I said, absolutely, bring him over. Got a knock on the door. Sherilyn was there. This kid has his hat backwards. He has the Nike clothes on, just like Agassi.
Pretty much what you look like right now.
Exactly. He's got the racket bag with about 8 rackets in the back. He looks at me and goes, hello. I said, g'day, Leighton. How's it going? I'm Darren. Nice to meet you. Yep, I know who you are. And I said, you want to go hit some tennis balls? He said, yep, let's go. This is 12 years of age. We go out to the back. We play 3 sets, I reckon. And I reckon I thump him pretty easily, love and won in the first couple of sets. But by the third set, I'm getting a little bit tired. He's getting fired up. He doesn't want to stop. He's giving me the fist pumps, the come-ons at 12 years of age. I'm looking around at my now wife, Victoria, going, is this kid serious? And by the end of it, he nearly ran me off my feet. And this is at 12 years of age.
Wow.
And I was still playing pretty good tennis.
Yeah.
So I came in after that practice session. We played for a couple of hours. And Victoria said to me, what do you think? Because she had seen me hit with a bunch of other kids as well. Mm. I went, oh my God, this kid is special.
Wow.
This kid has got something I haven't seen before. He was also getting coached by Peter Smith, another coach in South Australia, who'd done an amazing job with his technique. But he didn't really know how to play.
Yeah.
Great at technique, didn't know where to put the ball and how to utilize his game. So that sort of became my role, was to teach the kid how to play. I didn't worry so much about his technique. It was just where to put the ball.
Yeah, how to play point.
What positions in the court and how to stay alive.
Yeah.
And he did it great. He was like a sponge.
So you just stayed with him permanently after that?
Yeah, so we were together. Every time we was back in Adelaide, he would come over as much as possible. We worked together for about 4 or 5 years. He did a big breakthrough at the South Australian Open, won that tournament as a 16-year-old. He actually went away for the first year on tour, a little bit with Bob Carmichael, in fact, but a couple of other coaches. A couple of other coaches. I think his dad was travelling with him quite a bit. Didn't work out great. And so when he was about 18, just outside the top 100, they called me up. They asked me to go on the road before that, but they said, listen, can you take
him
on?
Were you still behind the bar at this point?
Yeah, I would have been. Yeah, I would have been doing a little bit of bar work, running around with this, that, and the other. I was, for sure. Still based in South Australia, doing a little bit of commentary work as well. Mm-hmm. And then they asked me to go full-time with him and take him on the road. And we did. We went to WA, played the Challenger over there. He broke through, won that tournament, the Challenger. And then he went from 100 to 22 in the first year. The second year, he went to 6. And the third year on the road, he went to 1.
Wow. That's a great story.
He's a great player, though.
Talk about... Yeah, but, you know, it's... it also is really important, I think, for people to understand that you might have a great talent and they have to be... Obviously have the desire and all of that. But it is important to have the right people around you.
For sure.
Particularly because, you know, it's a lot. It's a lot for a young kid. So that's a great story of Australians helping one another as well, you know. So you go from coaching Leighton, then you stop working with Leighton. How did you... The next coaching... for you was Andre?
Mm-hmm.
Jesus, it's not bad. So how did that come about?
I have a good story about that, actually.
That's why we're here.
Yeah, 2002, and I'm at the Aussie Open, and because I didn't know what I was doing, I was working for Channel 7. You do a little bit of work for Channel 7, or have done.
Yep.
And I had an agent come up to me, Amit Neil, come up to me. He works with Murat Safin. And says, I have a player I want you to work with. I'm talking him in. He doesn't have a coach. I'm talking him into appointing you as the coach. Can you come and have breakfast with me? I went and had breakfast with him. He went through the whole Murat story. And Murat's a little bit complicated as well. He'd already won the US Open. Great player, 6'5". I come back from that meeting, and I'm married now. My wife's there, Victoria. And we have a little baby as well, about Benjamin, who's at that stage about 9 months old.
Now he's taller than you.
Yeah, taller than I am. And she goes, where have you been? And I said, I've actually been in a meeting at a possible coaching job. And she goes, who is it? And I said, it's Murat Safin. She's like, oh my God, that's unbelievable. You've got to take that job. Oh my God, that guy is so hot.
So good looking.
Oh, he's so hot. You know, me and the girls, we've actually got tickets. We've been watching all of his matches here. I said, what? Oh, yeah. Where'd you get the tickets from? No, we go out and buy his tickets, and there's like 6 of us, and we go to all of his matches. That guy is smoking hot. He's the big, sexy Russian. You got to take that job. You know, don't worry.
I love that Vic is all she's concerned about is how good-looking are the people you're going to work with.
Okay, I'm going to give you some advice here. Don't worry about the money. This will be really good for you moving forward. You need to take this job. So whatever they offer you, don't worry. Let's take that job.
Bullshit.
And I'm looking at her going, are you serious? And she was dead serious.
Yeah, of course.
So... he goes on and does that tournament. He gets to the final and he loses to Thomas Johansson in the final. Every day she's coming up to me and she's saying, how's it going? Yeah, how's it going? Everything going well? What can I do? Can I do anything? She's super nice to me the whole tournament. And I'm thinking to myself, this is going to be interesting. And we get to the final. I'm not at the final. I'm sitting down watching it on TV. And can you remember that tournament?
Yeah, of course.
Okay,
yeah.
So he's in the final and he doesn't have a coach. He doesn't have an entourage. He has 3 girls.
Yeah, in the
player box, sitting there. And these 3 girls, I promise you, they look like working girls. They're not questionable. They look like working girls. They've got things hanging out of places hanging out of places. And I'm sitting there and Victoria's smirking at the television every time they flash onto these girls, which is pretty much after every point. And I look at her and I say, baby, you really want to be part of that? Look at those 3 girls. They look like 3 working girls.
Do you really want me around those 3 girls?
Well, there you go. You really want that to happen? She goes, baby, you call me number 4. That was exactly what she said. And I'm looking, I'm laughing now. And now I'm kind of thinking, I got to take the job anyway, right? Just to see where all this goes, right? Because us Aussies are a little bit sick anyway. So about 4 or 5 days later, I get a call and Victoria picks up the phone in my house and...
tell me it's not Murat.
No, it's Andre. Andre calls up and she goes, hello, Victoria speaking. And, you know, hey, it's Andre here. And we know Andre a little bit, not a lot. And he just had a kid, Jaden Agassi, about 3 months old. And actually about 6 months before that, I gave him a book called The Contented Little Baby Book, which is basically a Bible for people that travel and try to get the kids on a schedule. Mm-hmm. So I thought he was calling me about the book.
Yeah, thanks for the book.
So I get on the phone and Victoria hands it to me. And as she's handing it to me, she's giving me the waving finger, basically, we're not doing this. So I take the phone call and Andre goes, hey, how's it going? And I said, hey, how's that book? And he goes, what book? And I said, the book I gave you at the Sydney tournament 6 months. I left that in Sydney. No, I'm not calling you about the book. I'm calling you to see whether or not you'd like to coach me because Brad Gilbert and I have had a great 8 years together. But it's time for a change for both of us. And so I would love for you to think about coming over and coaching. So we have a 5-minute conversation. I hang up the phone. I tell him my problem that I've got that I've not agreed to, but a long way down the path with Murat. I hang up the phone and Victoria goes, this ain't going to happen, killer. We are not doing this. We have a 22-year-old, 6'5", hot, sexy Russian in Murat Safin. And we have, how old's Andre? Like 48, 49 years old. He's bald. He walks like a duck. We're not taking that. We're going for the Russian guy. And I'm laughing. And two minutes later, the phone rings again. And it's Andre again. And he goes, hey, so I've been thinking what you've been talking about with Murat. You can't take that job. That guy is a runaway train. He's a loose cannon. And you don't want your wife around that guy.
Come on.
He said this. And I started laughing. So I'm not hanging up the phone until you give me the yes that you're going to take this job. I said, all right, I take the job. And I hung up the phone. So that's how I got the job with Agassi, with him for the next 5 years. I could go on and on about the story, but to cut the long story short, we get across to San Francisco. The whole time my wife is going, killer, this is a miss. What are you going to be able to teach him? This guy's already a legend. This could be in Russia right now. Here we are going to San Francisco. We walk into Andre's house. She's nervous. I'm nervous. It's 29 Grand Slam trophies sitting in this house, 22 from Steph and 7 from Andre.
Yeah.
Walk in the house, Steph's as nice as you can be, Andre's as nice as you can be. He picks us up from the airport, she's a bit nervous. We walk into the house, they take us to where we're actually
staying
and sleeping. And we've got this massive big room, it's a place in Tiburon, I think it's worth about $22-23 million.
Yep.
One view over the Golden Gate Bridge, one view over the Bay Bridge, looking over the water.
Gorgeous.
Victoria looks around to me and she goes,
all right,
killer, good call. Don't fuck this up. Her words exactly. And I would just, that made me more nervous now because now I had to make sure it worked.
And you couldn't fuck it up.
Exactly. So that's the story of how I got the job with Agassi.
How great was that 5 years? Because, you know, you had that, it was very different with Leighton because you're sort of, you know, molding a young man. And then you go to someone like Andre who, as Vic says, is a legend. And who I know quite well as well, is quite opinionated and how he sees things and how he views things, but he's also very malleable in listening to your point of view. How life-changing was that experience with him? Because he's quite a philosopher.
He's deep.
Yeah.
And I think the reason why it worked quite well was because Australians in general are quite black and white, and we can simplify really quickly. Mm. Andre is incredibly bright and very deep, and he can make the easy really difficult sometimes. Mm. You can give him a complex problem, and he'll break it down, and you'll go, oh, God, I didn't even think of that.
Yeah.
But sometimes if things are a bit simple for him, he can make it much more difficult than it needs to be. So I think his personality and my personality seem to gel quite well with that. I could simplify a little bit what he was trying to accomplish and work on the tennis court, break down opponents' strengths and weaknesses, work out through his eyes what would be more valuable for him to do more often. And also, we talk quite a bit about coaching, is that you don't always have to bring your A game. The most important thing in tennis is to find a way to win, especially when you're not playing well. And Andre didn't like that. He quite often would let matches go if he wasn't playing close to his best because he got so upset with himself.
Yeah.
And it's so important that you don't get to number one in the world and you don't win majors unless you just survive.
Yeah.
And then you continue to work on your game throughout the course of the tournament. You don't always have to be playing your best tennis. So some of his best wins in those last couple of years when he'd walk off the court, he'd hit 6 winners and 6 unforced errors, walk off the court and think, I don't think I played that well today.
Yeah.
And he beat Richard Gasquet 2-2.
Yeah.
You know, that was some of his best wins because it was finding a way to win that he wasn't used to.
How hard was it to see him at the end struggle physically?
Yeah, that was a tough finish.
And knowing how much he loved playing.
Yeah, which goes against his book a little bit, right?
It does. Well, I think loving the the competitive sort of part of the game was what drew him in the end to loving the sport, was that he actually really, he loved it, you know.
Well, he found a reason to play as well, and that was through education and providing education for the underprivileged back in Vegas, building the school. And that gave him a real impetus to get out there and make it happen, not so much for himself, but a real reason to keep winning and keep playing. The last 12 months were difficult, but not as difficult as what people think, because firstly, he was a pleasure to be around, also for me. We had very honest conversations throughout the course of that period about continuing to try. Mm. Remember, in 2000, he finished in 2006. In 2005, he had one of his best years, and he made it through to the US Open final.
Yep.
At 35 years of age, winning...
Lost to Roger, no?
Lost to Roger. Yep. He had a settle, I remember this like it was yesterday, settle, really windy day, 4-2 in the third set, 30 love on serve with the breeze. Mm. And we were thinking, uh-oh. You know, and Roger didn't like playing him back in those days. So there was a good chance he was going to win that match. Roger hit a little lucky return at 30 love that landed on the line, played a good point, 30 all. Andre got a little bit tight, 30-40, Roger breaks, bang. The match just changed on a dime. But before that match, he won three matches, I think it was fourth round, quarters and semis, all in five sets to get through to the final at 35 years of age, which is one of the most amazing things I've ever seen.
What was the thing that, if you had to sum him up in one word, maybe two, because you're as verbose as me, what would it be?
He loved watching opponents suffer. It's a little bit like Rafa, but Rafa does it differently because he's so athletic on the court. Andre would plant himself on the baseline and take time away from players, and they would feel like they played three sets against Andre when they've only played one set because you just couldn't breathe when he was playing his... I played him. I was on the back end of a 2-2 beating when I thought I was playing really well, and you can't breathe because there's nowhere to go. You can't serve volley, you can't stay back, you can't bring him in because he's hitting the ball too hard. He just runs you from side to side. He got enjoyment out of watching players suffer, and he would actually, believe it or not, could thump someone easily if he wanted to, but he would extend matches just to make the opponent suffer a little bit more, to send them a message: next time you play me, it's going to be worse.
It's going to be worse.
Yeah,
that's so fun.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
So that brings me to, the Andre coaching situation finishes. You take up a bit of a consulting role, I believe, at Adidas at that period of time. So is that how the connection came with Simona? And what's the difference? What was your thought process in going into the female coaching? Because it's, I would consider, very different.
Why? You answer that question. Why is it different?
Well, because I would say that, well, I guess in some respects, being with Andre, being so philosophical and sort of thinking and being a little bit more tough on himself, it was probably not a bad transition to go to working with females who I feel think a lot, almost too much about why they're not winning or what's the outcome, and they worry too much about the outcome. Guys are a little bit less about the outcome and more about just, you know, point by point, and they don't get so worried about the emotional side of it, whereas Andre probably did. So. Yeah. Probably wasn't that big of a transition for you.
No, it wasn't.
All right, you explain it.
No, you're right. But I think the mental game is a little bit different.
Yeah.
The tennis itself is not that different at all. It's the same lines, the same problems, the same trying to find ways to finish points. You know, it's the same principles as the men's game compared to the women's game. But the mental game is a little bit different. I think simply because male player with a big serve gets up a set and a break, you can coast to the finish line. Yep. You have a strength that you can win 3 points, you can relax a little bit, and you can find your way to the finish line fairly comfortably. Not all the time, but fairly comfortably. The women can't, unless you're Serena, because you don't have a big weapon that can get you there. So you have to continue to execute the game plan, stay on course, deal with the nerves, have the ability to continue to be brave. You know, there's a lot of variables that come into it.
So that's emotionally taxing.
Exactly.
You're constantly having to check.
Yeah.
So check your brain.
That's right.
Check your heart. You know, not get too far ahead, not get too far behind. And so that's, I don't think people are, like, staying in the now, literally, is so difficult.
And you can disappear from the now with the men as well. You know, when Federer gets up a set and a break, the return games, he can disappear. Yeah. He can be relaxed and give it away, and then he just switches it on for the Roddick. Yeah, I can go through all the men, basically. It's the same principle. So they can cut themselves away from the mental breaks. The women cannot. So a lot of the women get a hard time for being perceived to be mentally weak. It's just not the case. Mm. And there are so many more variables that come into play. I had a little bit of a trial run because with Adidas, I got to work with a bunch of the female players on a consulting role, and some of them actually more full-time. The year that I was with Simona for the last 9 months, I was helping Simona and Angie Kerber were my two players. A little more with Simona because of the fact that Angie was working with Torben, so I was consulting to the team, and Simona didn't really have a coach, so I was assuming that full-time coaching role. We got to the US Open, Adidas discontinued the job, and then we got to the US Open and Simona sat me down and asked me whether or not I would like to consider working with her full-time the next year.
And you had to juggle then because, you know, cut to a little bit, your ESPN role, because you're now working full-time for ESPN at the Grand Slams, etc., and different weeks on the road, and you had to juggle that as well with her, and how was she with that? And you still are with ESPN, as am I. It's not easy because, you know, you don't want to be seen as favouring one player, but obviously it's, you know, everybody knows you're coaching somebody, so obviously you're going to favour them. But you also want to be respected in the fact that you actually love the competition of everybody. You don't want to see anyone do poorly.
Correct.
But it was a tough juggle for you.
Yeah, it was. I think more so for Simona at first. I'm not the perfect coach for her because the biggest tournaments in the world are the Grand Slams. And so you want somebody, ideally, to be there fully invested 24/7 for that player. And with my role with ESPN, you're not during the Grand Slams. Yeah. Even though I think sometimes coaches can smother the players and a little bit of a break is not a bad thing as well.
Yeah.
It's not perfect. So I was upfront and honest, and she knew exactly what my role was at ESPN. And so it was her decision. I said, this is my role.
Yeah.
I'm not perfect. I would love to do it if you want me to do it, but it comes with a few handbrakes. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So this is completely up to you. If you don't want me to do this, we can work together to help you get the right person. And she said, no, absolutely not. I'm fine with it. Mm. And she wasn't a youngster. She was 27 now, so maybe 24. Mm. And she was already a great player, so she knew the deal. And she has a really good team around her anyway. Teo Sassel has been a strength and conditioning trainer for the last 10 years, and he's been the rock and the unsung hero behind her. So it was her decision, and it's always been her decision, and she could have gotten rid of me at any time. So she asked me, what'd you do with Andre? How'd you get that deal done? And I said, actually, we went to we did a six-week trial, and then we went and bought some takeaway for our wives. And on the way down there, he said, all right, this is how much I would like to pay you. I'd like you to be my full-time coach. And I said, okay. And he goes, do you need a contract? I said, not if you do. And he goes, all right, we shake on it. We shook hands and that was it.
Yeah.
So I told Simona the story and she said, I want the same deal. I said, all right, how much are you going to pay me? Exactly.
Before
so it took about 30 seconds. We shook hands and we haven't spoken about it since. That's it.
That's unbelievable.
Yeah, it's 3 years ago.
So look, everybody knows you had that period of time where you had a break, right?
Yeah.
Because, you know, Simona, right? I mean, she's Romanian and they're fiery and they're fun to watch, but they're difficult to work with sometimes because they get so pissed off at themselves.
Yeah.
You have that break and you come back to working with her. What was the difference, the biggest difference from that period of time? Because it was an important one for her.
Yeah, it was after Miami playing Paczynski, and it wasn't just from that match.
Yeah.
And there were a bunch of matches that were slipping away from her. And we were speaking through the mental game quite a lot and what's expected of her and what she needs to do to improve that side of her tennis to get to the top, to win majors, because you can't have mental lapses and expect everything to go right throughout the course of a Grand Slam or the course of a year, because it just won't. There are so many things you can't control. you have to control what you can control. That's the most
controllables.
That's the most important thing in tennis. So she'd lost a bunch of matches where it was slipping away from her in the same way, and I was trying and trying to get through her, and the words weren't getting through. So you, as a coach, you have to be prepared to try something different, walk away, a little bit of a shock tactic. It had to be up to her. She had to buy into it. She had to accept that she had to get better. There were certain things that we'd put in place that she wasn't following through with. So either she did that with me or she found somebody else to do that with. And so we took a bit of a break for about 4 weeks. She went away and thought about things, tried to improve on what she was doing on the court, would call me up after a match to see if I was watching, to see if she was better. She certainly was. And then just before Madrid started, she asked me if I'd come back. And I said, yeah, I've seen enough to believe that you're not perfect, but you're buying into it and you're trying, and that's good enough for me. So away we go.
What did she learn from the loss in Paris when she was up a set in three?
Yeah, that's two break. Three love, three break points for four love. I'm not sure you can really learn anything from that apart from...
Really?
Yeah, because it was such a kick in the stomach.
I remember specifically one game, the three love game when she threw a racket.
Yeah.
And I remember thinking to myself watching that, I was watching it at home.
The career went against her.
And it wasn't even that. My first initial thought when she threw a racket was, what the F are you doing?
Yeah.
You've just given her one slight crack of the window to actually believe there's a chance mm-hmm. that she could win that match. That was if there was one moment, we all have moments in our careers mm-hmm. where we look back. I mean, mine wasn't the enormity of that. But I actually had the biggest moment of my career where I learned my biggest lesson on that same court, where I got so angry that I missed a really easy overhead, and I literally was trying to tube my opponent in the semi-finals of the French Open doubles, and I lost the point. I was on set point, and we lost the set, and we were up a break, and we ended up losing the match. And I remember thinking to myself, I can never get to the point of being that angry that all I want to do is actually to make a point rather than win the point. And
it's well said.
And then we won Wimbledon 3 weeks later.
Yeah.
And it taught me the biggest lesson. And it was the hardest thing because I never won the French Open.
Yeah.
It was the only Grand Slam I never won. So that moment for me was massively pivotal in that match.
And we did talk about that.
Yeah.
That was a moment we spoke about. There were other little ones as well. We did speak about that one because the crowd actually turned against her
mm-hmm.
before that, because she's up a set and a break, and the crowd, very
match.
Smart tennis crowd is the French Open crowd. And so they basically thought what you thought. Why would she do that? And I think it was 15-all, so it was for...
It was 15.
Yeah, 30-15. Yeah. But then she won the next point. She won the next point for break point and had two more after that. She was devastated after that match, and that loss stayed with her for a long time. She had a couple of chances for number one after that loss. She lost to Konta in the quarters of Wimbledon. She lost to Muguruza also in the final of Cincinnati, got thumped by Garbiñe. That match was for number one also, not just the Grand Slam title, but that match stayed with her for a long, long time. And I don't think until she played Beijing, where she made it through to the final, finally became number one, was she able to push that match away from her a little bit. And that was important for her to have that win. That win over Sharapova in Beijing early, after losing to her at the US Open in the first round. Great match, but again, just played waiting for her opponent to lose instead of taking it to her opponent. That one taught her a lot of lessons. I think more than anything, that loss she took against Sharapova at the US Open last year taught her more about a game than any loss she's had.
Why?
Because she played well and she lost.
Yeah.
And normally when she plays well, she wins.
Yeah.
And so she was asking herself a bunch of questions.
What do I need to do?
Why did I lose this match? Where do I need to improve? Because this, I don't even understand this.
And where was it?
First round of the French Open. Of the US Open.
No, what was it that she needed to work on that you felt?
Yeah, her court positioning, her ability to step up when her opponent hits a short ball and take a little more risk. Her serving patterns were way too predictable.
Yeah.
There was about six or seven things that we sat down after that particular match that she knew, we'd spoken about them, but she wasn't buying into. And straight after that loss, she didn't have a break. She went back to Bucharest. She started training on the very things that we were working on. And then lo and behold, she has an unbelievable week in Beijing.
Yeah, that's so cool. I think that's what people don't realize is that players, to really get better, to really get to that next level, everybody has to reassess, right? And that was a great reassess moment. It's interesting how you can lose and how it can be the biggest difference in winning future matches. Okay, so we cut to the Aussie Open. you know, some of the most phenomenal matches that I've ever witnessed at the Australian Open. And I don't know what it is about Simona, but my God.
She likes to make me suffer.
If I can please put my hand up to commentate any matches, it is Simona's, because they're so fun to watch. But that match in the semis against Kerber is one of the great matches I've ever seen.
Lauren Davis also.
Lauren Davis over 4 hours. And the final, was also... you know, besides the... I don't really want to get into the minutiae of, like, winning and losing and those Grand Slams, but how frigging stressful is it? Because I know now. Sitting on the... I mean, you played, I played. We've been through big matches. How... Just explain to people at home how fucking stressful it is to be a coach, because it's so stressful, because you have so much onus on what you're telling them.
Yeah.
And they look to you with those eyes and before matches and after matches, and it's so stressful.
You're not as old as me, so you're going to learn to disconnect a little bit from the stress of every point, because when you first start coaching, you ride every point like it, the whole match is riding on it. So...
I'm pretty rough. Yeah, okay. I'm not too bad. But yeah, it's...
I had Mark Williams. Mark Williams is another Australian I grew up with, who was the former coach of... great Collingwood footballer, former coach of Port Adelaide, coach in Victoria. And he's sort of been my mentor throughout my career. And he sat behind me through the course of the Australian Open. And he's a pretty cool, calm, collected guy. He's been there at the top level of the game as a coach and a player. He was stressed to his eyeballs. Just what he looked at me quite, and he was like, "How do you do this?" it's what people that sit in our box, that come and they're visitors to our box, sick because she's so connected to the box, are stressed to the max. And she makes us a little bit stressed as well because of her personality. But you gotta love it. It's because she's so invested. She wants to win so badly. She wants to please everybody in the box and do the right thing by them. And she gives everything she has. So you can't.
I got an interesting... Kamal Murray actually said, just for your... I don't know if he's told you this, but he said in the finals of Canada this past year in Montreal, I think it was, and one of the best matches maybe the best match I've seen all year, actually, between Sloane and Simona. He said to OG, who's sitting next to him, who's with Sloane's crew, he looked at it, I think it was 2-2 in the third, and he said, "Man, I don't care what happens here. You got to love this." Because it was that good. I mean, even for a coach who's sitting there stressed out, you're just like, man, you got to actually love this. Yeah. And then there are moments where you're like, shit, I feel so privileged. I mean, me doing courtside too as well for ESPN. Yeah. And I'm like, God, I'm so lucky to do this job and watch these kids and these girls go out there and just give it everything they've got,
Mm-hmm.
I think that's the one thing that we have to appreciate a little bit more about what they do. You told me also after she won in Paris, You should see the crowd, Stubbsy.
Yeah.
Like the pressure on her at home with... She is such a superstar.
Yeah.
But yet, I have to tell you, we took a flight this year because I hitched a ride with her on the private plane from Montreal to Cincinnati. Thank you for that, Simo. But she's such a humble person.
Yeah.
Like she's actually such a sweet person.
Yeah.
Like we try and jab her a little bit with our, coarseness and our typical Australian stuff, and she kind of, it goes over her head sometimes, and she's just...
She doesn't go over her head.
Like you said to her, "Why are we giving Stubbsy a ride to Cincinnati?" And you were trying to get one certain question out of her, and she said, "Because she's nice." I just want people to know at home how sweet she is as a human being. She's actually a really good person.
Yeah, it is tough to describe the pressure that she's been under the last 4 or 5 years and expectation. Jon Tyriac, who everybody knows, he owns Madrid and he's been around for forever, and he's sort of like the godfather of Romania. And he pulled me aside a few times and basically said, "Listen, she needs to win a major because the country needs it. Mm. We need this. Romania's had a tough 30 or so years, and the culture of Romanians is a little bit of a negative one. And her doing what she's doing and winning a major, because we don't have a great football team and she's the biggest superstar in sport that we have, if she wins a major, it changes everything in Romania. So when someone like that pulls you aside and puts a little bit of extra pressure on you to make it happen, you feel it. So if I was feeling it, she was feeling it times 100. And she can't go anywhere in Romania, obviously. It's she is the biggest athlete there. And dealing what she's had to deal with the last 3 years that I've been with her and the way she's done it, I have nothing but respect for her, because it hasn't been easy for her. And she deserves everything that she's earned. Great respect from the fans that she have in Romania. 99% of the fans in Romania are fully behind her and they give her enormous support. She has a little bit of a tough time with the media sometimes, that anything she says that ends up on the front page of a paper on a negative angle. Mm. But by and large, I think she deserves and has earned to be well respected, and she's done a great job.
Yeah, you said that her winning the French was the best day of your career.
Yeah, no, because of the journey.
Yeah.
Because sometimes, I think I used a quote about sometimes the most beautiful destinations are the bumpiest roads. Mm. And we personally had a bit of a bumpy road getting there as well. And I had a front row seat to watching her on that bumpy road get there. So for me, it was a proud moment to see her finally do it and knowing what it meant to her and also the people back in Romania.
I want to, we're getting to the end of this, but you told me a really fun story, aside from the coaching and your playing days, is that, you know, you've become one of the best commentators and analysts in the sport of tennis. You really are. You told me a great story about Dick Emberg.
Mm, yeah.
You want to tell us that one?
Yeah, Dick's a legend of commentating in the US, and he'd worked for all the big networks for American football and for tennis, and he was legendary for ESPN doing Wimbledon. And one of my first years of working Wimbledon, they actually rostered me with Dick on center court at Wimbledon.
Big
and
deal.
I was huge for me. And I was so nervous. I think it was Federer playing as well. Yeah. So I got Dick Emberg, legend of broadcasting, Federer playing, and then doing it on center court. And I'm about to, and I didn't have a great deal of experience, and I'm about to walk into the booth. And Dick's got all these papers lined out across his desk, and he's got the highlighter out, and he's got things circled. He's got all this work done, the homework. Oh my God, it was. And I walk in there and I have nothing. I have one sheet of paper, basically with a few hit points and a couple of little notes that I've jotted down.
I only care about head to head, that's all I care about.
Yeah, and I put this little piece of paper down. I went, oh, Dick, I feel so embarrassed. You know, I'm so sorry, you know. And I knew Dick was always nice to me, but we'd never actually worked together. And I'm so sorry that I, look at all the work you've done. You've done all this homework and I've got this one piece of paper. And he goes, son, sit down. So I sit down and he goes, I would be really worried if you walked in with all these pieces of paper because you're the expert. I'm not. And you're the one that's supposed to tell me what I don't see. You're the one that's supposed to break this match down and give the viewer what they are not seeing. So if you walk in here with all these papers, you might as well take those papers and get the hell out of here. I went, oh, thanks. then away we went. And I got to call a match with Dick Emberg, and it went really well. And he couldn't have been more friendly to work with and inclusive because, as you know, sometimes working with a legend can not be easy sometimes, but he was so inclusive and brought me into everything that he made my job a lot easier.
Okay, so last couple of things. Your kids are playing tennis. You're out there with your son playing a lot of tennis these days. And how tough is it for the kids, like your family, to have to sort of, I don't know, live up to your name? Because, you know, your dad was very famous playing football. You're very famous in tennis. Yeah. How difficult is it for your kids, maybe?
Well, if you ask my son, it's not that difficult because he's pretty super relaxed about the whole thing and just goes about his business. And I try to tell him a couple of things. He's going, what would you know? So it's
really?
Yeah, he's a little more...
Is
listening.
He smart? Is he got a sort of tennis brain?
I think so. He's an old school serve volleyer, so he likes to come forward. And he's 17. He would love to go off to US college and do 4 years over there. He does a lot better in school than I used to do, so he's going to fit in there nicely. But the way the tennis is these days is that it's much more of an older sport, I think, both on the men's side and the women's side. Yeah, so I think having options like US going over there between the ages of 18 to 21, 22 is a great option for players now. And they do a wonderful job over there. And he's kind of a US kid anyway, because of the job with Andre, he basically was over there from 1 until about 15 years of age. So the kids came back to Australia with US accents. Talia's...
Oh, God, hilarious.
Yeah, Talia,
well,
my daughter.
A lot of time in Vegas.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And she's 14. She's Simona's biggest fan.
Yeah.
She loves it. So... The kids, they love tennis, they embrace it. But they're back into the Australian way of life now. They do a lot of the Aussie sports. Talia's a netball back there, and Victoria's getting more involved in netball as well. So can't beat the Aussie life. It's great people, great education, great way of life back in Australia. So it'll be interesting with us once the kids want to go back to the States and go back to college. We might find ourselves back there, I think.
Mm, really?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's all the world is your oyster.
Correct.
It's kind of a nice... That's the one thing about tennis is that, you know, it takes you around the world. You meet so many great people. All right, last question. What's the funniest story that you think from your playing days, whether it be coaching, playing, that you can remember, that you can finish on?
It's going to take a couple of minutes.
That's fine.
It's a bit embarrassing for me.
That's perfect.
All right.
That's awesome. That's why we're here on the
My
Rapid
by far
podcast.
The most embarrassing and funniest story comes from the German Open. I won a match against Ronald Agenor in the first round, and I was due to play Lendl in the second round. And clay was not my best surface, so I hurt myself in the groin a little bit on my match against Agenor, and I went into the training room. And Bill Norris, who was a trainer in there, and I walked over to Bill and said, Bill, I've got a bit of a problem. I've tweaked my groin a little bit. And he goes, go over to her and she'll look after you. And I said, yeah. And I said, Billy, it's a lady. It's a killer. I'm busy. You can see there's players everywhere, trainers looking at it. She was the only one free. And she's fine. Everyone's a pro here, killer. Stop wasting my time. Get over there and tell it. So I get over there and I start. And he also said, listen, her English is not great, so talk slowly. So I get over there. You know what it's like when someone doesn't speak great English. My English goes to hell too. So you start to say something like, so slide and groin. You start speaking pidgin English when you just, if you speak normally, they have a much better chance of understanding you. And she's like, oh, okay. Speaking English, not so good. You know, mm-hmm. It was a table and just point. So I point to it. I take my towel off. I got the box of shorts on. And now she starts to work her way up the leg a little bit. And now these problems, as every boy who's about 18, 19 years of age starts to worry about. And I'm going, oh, my God. And think ugly. Just think as ugly as you can possibly think. It didn't work. And the little guy starts to poke his head up a little bit and have a bit of a look around. And I got a towel over it and whatnot. But now I'm burying my head in the pillow, just going, don't do this, don't do this. She was a total pro. She just kept pushing into the area. I was in pain, but it didn't matter. The little guy still having a look around, seeing what's going on through the towel. Anyway, I come up after she's finished. It was about 15 minutes. It felt like an hour. It was like 15
You're
minutes.
Sweating.
So I'm sweating telling the story because I live the story every day in my mind. I come up and Bill Norris is laughing his head off. So everyone obviously saw what was going on. Everyone's looking. I get up. I look at the lady. Hilda, I think her name was.
Hilda.
I said, Hilda, I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry if that was uncomfortable. In perfect English, she says, don't worry. It wasn't big enough to get in the way. That was the most embarrassing tennis story I've got for you. I'm sorry that it embarrassed, but
oh my God.
Verbatim, locker room just cracked up. I walked out, jumped in the shower, got my bag, went home and didn't come out of my hotel room for like 2 days. Oh, and ended up losing to Lendl like 2-0 the next day because I couldn't play.
Killer. I'm shaking your hand on that one. That is a ripper. Thank you for joining me.
My pleasure. Stop.
Only an Aussie would tell that story with pride, even with a sweat. Hey, listen, just to finish on, well done, Simona. World number one again this year.
Thank you.
2 years in a row.
Yeah.
You've done an amazing job with an amazing person.
Yeah, she's a rock star.
So thanks for joining me here in Singapore. Are you going home tonight?
Going home. Well done with your show as well. I hear you're doing great things
thanks.
With it.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. I've got to put another hat on later on today. But
good luck.
Yeah, thanks, mate. I appreciate it.
And that's it for this episode of the Racquet Magazine podcast. Thanks for listening. Our host is Renee Stubbs. Our co-host and producer is me, Caitlin Thompson. Music by internationally renowned DJ Stretch Armstrong. Thanks to Tim Ruggieri, Taylor Dalton, and the team at Acast. Find us at racquetmag.com/podcast and subscribe to us at any of your favorite podcatchers.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.